is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Stocks are up on this Friday, at least at the time we're doing this interview. We had the unemployment numbers come out. Still that weakening trend that we're seeing. New jobs created, 215,000 loss of industrial jobs. A lot of the jobs that were created were mainly in the service sector and retail. But nonetheless, Janet Yellen gave a very bullish speech this week. The market seemed to like that. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Coming up in Hour 1 today, Robin Griffith will be joining me. And last time on the show, he called the bottom of the market. He says, this is really a bear market rally. We may go sideways, but we haven't hit the bottom yet. He doesn't see that happening till next year. You want to hear what he has to say about that, as well as gold. Also, Kurt Wolf will be joining me in the hour. We think oil prices have bottomed. There's some good bargains out there. So Kurt and I will be talking about oil and oil stocks. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler in Hour 2 of the program today. Boy, do we have a special big picture for you. Jim Rickards will be the guest for the entire hour. His new book, A New Case for Gold, and he is going to say some things you probably never thought of before, including, where is all the gold? Who's got it? There's the old joke, if someone discovered that there was no gold in Fort Knox, they'd have to double the guard so no one would find out, rather than worry about if somebody would steal it. So we're going to talk about that in the second hour of the program today on The Big Picture, as Jim Rickards is our guest.
Well, after a perilous start to the beginning of the year, investors have something to cheer about. Stocks are going up, and it's not just stocks. Most asset classes around the globe are rising. Is this the beginning of a new bull market, or just simply a rally in a bear market? Joining us on the program is Robin Griffith. Robin, let's start with the major averages. With the S&P, we had that sort of double bottom that we saw in January and February, but since then, stocks have been relentlessly rising.
Yeah. I'm afraid it's a bear market rally, though. It has all of the hallmarks of a bear market rally. I actually got the bottom of the bear market rally correct to the day. And at the time, slightly tongue-in-the-cheek, said it will go on until Wednesday the 23rd of March at 3:30 in the afternoon. UK time, of course, which, and for a while it looked as though that was the top of the rally. The point I was making, seriously, is that significant bear market rallies on average last 5 weeks. So not 5 minutes, not 5 days, but 5 weeks. There are one or two that last roughly double that, and they destroy the averages a bit. But the mean is about a 5 week rally. So when you're going for a decent bear market rally, it's safe to trade for a 5 week rally. After that, you're to some extent on borrowed time. I think what's happened is this market was topping, and then, of course, Janet Yellen has come out and been as dove-like as it's possible for her to be. And just at the moment, the US dollar is weakening off, which is allowing Canadian dollars, Aussie dollars, and metals and mining and all of those things that were super depressed to be rallying. But everything suggests to me that the world is, in fact, in a bear market. And what we're having is the end of the first bear market rally. And according to my work, the final low of the bear market is not now. It's not even this year. It's next year. And will be quite a bit lower than we are now in virtually all markets.
Why do you feel this is a bear market rally? In other words, what are you looking at that tells you that this is a bear market rally?
It's clearer in the things like oil that have really rallied dramatically. Whenever a move up is exceptionally violent and vicious, as it's been in the price of oil, usually the buying power is short covering. It's the bears closing their banking a profit. And this always causes a much more vicious rally than genuine long-term buyers coming in with a rosy view of the future. And most of the things that have rallied really strongly, and the price of oil is right up there, that clearly is short covering. And of course, once the shorts are all covered, the next trade is likely to reinforce the last trade that made a profit. They're shorted again at the higher levels. In the case of something like oil, we're still in a position where the world has got massive excess supply and a lack of demand. So that's the underlying fundamental. And you don't fall 80% and then make a nice little V-shaped bottom on the chart and go back to the good old days. That is just so unlikely. I can't get my head around betting that way at all. It's much more likely that the rally runs out of steam and we go back down to make a more important base than the V-shaped base that we've got, and at much better value. When you come to the stock markets, and of course in the Western world, the strongest one probably is the US, its economy is in better shape than many others in the Western world, but it's definitely cooling down. And it's not good. We haven't had the productivity gains that, you know, Western capitalism is supposed to deliver. And as we know, if you're not a fat cat on Wall Street or a banker, the average American is actually worse off now than he was in the year 2000. And he knows this, and he's going to express himself in the voting box, which is why the run-up to the U.S. election is such a very unusual experience we're having right now. I mean, people that people thought had no chance are the ones that seem to be doing best in the polls, and it's not just Donald. It's not working out normally. Funnily enough, using the cycle word that I've always got and have been using for years, which is my variation of Schumpeter's model, it's working out a treat, because what normally happens on the annual seasonal cycle is the stock market runs all the way up to late May. You sell in late May and go away. What normally happens on the next cycle, which is the presidential election cycle, is the stock market runs up to and through the election date, and whoever wins gets at least a brief honeymoon period before the reality attack. And then finally, on the stronger, longer cycle, which is the 10-year cycle, what normally happens is the first 1 to 3 years of the decade are relatively wishy-washy, not necessarily negative, but they just don't do much. And then the fourth and fifth year of the decade get really going into a bull market, with the fifth year typically the strongest of the decade. And then the corrections come in the sixth, with crashes like in the seventh year of the decade, and you end the decade with a rally. And that's what normally happens. But, and this back tests, if the election that you're coming up to is at the end of a two-term president, who therefore, by definition, is now a lame duck, and the market has to go for some form of change. And if, secondly to that, the fifth year of the decade, against the normal odds, was not a brilliant year, but put a major high in place, then the prediction is different, and what you get is what we're getting now. You begin the year really badly. We've just had the worst January in decades, and the old maxim, as January goes, so goes the year, is also a high probability. You then do get a rally. The rally doesn't normally last till late May, hence my call, slightly tongue-in-cheek, for late March. It can go on a little bit more now, courtesy of Janet Yellen, but I don't think a long way more. And then, for about a month, it'll go sort of a little bit neutral, just up and down, but not really making any progress. No new money really coming into the market. And at the higher levels, the people that just want to get out actually do some selling, because their view of the future is that the likely returns we're going to get from safe equities now is close to zero looking forward for quite a few years now. And then relentlessly negative for the rest of the year. As I say, with the final low likely next year. When we look at the valuation, particularly on the US, it was very interesting. For a long while, I was very worried that the Shiller PE was dramatically high. It was 24 or 5, which is well into bubble territory. It's only ever been exceeded once, which was in the year 2000. And of course, we reacted badly down from there. However, if we strip out those 8 famous stocks from one area of California, FANG and NOSH were the acronyms for them. Those were the stocks on super high multiples. If you strip them out, the P/E ratio for the rest of the market, for the broader market, is around 17. Now, that's expensive, but it's not bubble territory. And you only are vulnerable to a crash if you're in bubble territory. So I think that the FANGs of this world, they peak for the time being, and the broader market is simply expensive. According to Benjamin Graham's book, I mean, in round numbers, you bought things under 8x earnings because they were cheap, and you sold them at 16x earnings because they're expensive. So 17 is the top end of expensive, but it's not bubble. And that's why I don't think it's necessarily a slam dunk that you go for a crash. But you certainly do need to go for the market to come down and be cheaper. All of the economic indicators that we've got are that the Western world economy is definitely cooling down and in some parts is already in recession right now. In the case of the US, it's the better end of the spectrum, but it's definitely cooling rather than heating up. And I don't think we can get away from that. And then you factor in the geopolitical risks are frankly nightmarish at the moment, not just in the Middle East, but elsewhere as well. And the probability of making money by running out and buying something aggressively is really vanishingly small. And the probability of losing money is really rather high. When I rank in descending order of merit all of the asset classes in the world, I do this ranking in dollars, in sterling, in yen, and in euros. So, and you get slightly different answers depending on which currency you're in. But basically, I rank them into quintiles. If we were in a bull market, the equity indices would all be in the top quintile, and cash, bonds, and inverse equities or short selling would be the bottom quintile. But at the moment, that's not what we've got. In spite of or including the rally recently, equities are all in the lower quintiles, well below zero. As it happens, the US market is one of the stronger of equity markets, but it's still in the bottom quintile. And what my work is suggesting is, if you're a hedge fund, putting on some new shorts into this rally now is a really good idea and actually makes you a profit. Holding some cash is a slightly less good idea because what cash does is it stops you losing. It doesn't actually make you richer. And the things that have been going up have been high-quality government bonds, gold bullion, to some extent silver, but only the precious metals, and inverse equities or short selling. So that can't happen if we're in a bull market, basically. Then when we look to places like China, and the China economy is pretty darn important, that is obviously in a bear market. There was a bubble bursting experience, and it entered a bear market to correct that. And on a chart, the shape of a bear market we always look for is of a major fall, followed by a rally, followed by the rest of the fall. That's the sort of Elliott wave shape. And in rough numbers, the first fall was 50%, the rally was 20%, and we're now into the last fall. But I mean, because although it looks as though it will get to its final low this year, ahead of the Western world, it's still vulnerable to quite a big percentage drop on the downside as the credit bubble has to be deflated. I think very recently, the thing that has changed was the stance of the Fed. And Janet Yellen, in her latest speech, made incredibly dove-like remarks, so that the market had gone from previously expecting 4 rate hikes this year to now, well, okay, we might get 2, but they'll be very baby weeny ones, won't they? She's not going to rock the boat here. She's quite clearly permitting the US dollar to be weak now, which means you get a strong bounce back in all those things that get punished by a strong dollar, which includes gold and oil and certain precious metals, if not base metals. And those economies that rely on commodity-type products. But how far are we going to extrapolate the weakness in the dollar? I look at it on the trade-weighted basis, and it's basically been in a range now for almost 2 years of 93 to 100. It's coming back down to the bottom of that range. But only if it breaks below 93, you say, okay, that was the top of the dollar. The dollar's now in a bear market. But how bullish does that make you of U.S. stocks if you've suddenly decided your one haven of value, the U.S. dollar, is actually going down now and officially being, as it were, permitted to go down by the Fed? It's pretty difficult to be bullish about that.
Let me stop you there for a minute, because two questions. Number one, as you mentioned, when you back out the Silicon Valley social media type stocks, the FANG stocks, that the PE ratio of the market, it's overvalued, but it's not in bubble territory, implying not a crash. So the first question, do you see this as a slow grinding bear market, number one? And number two, given the recent dovishness by the Fed and the fact that from our work, we've seen a peak, our view is we've seen a peak in the business cycle. So if the economies are slowing both here and abroad, does the Fed become more dovish? In other words, start talking about lowering rates or QE versus this talk about how many rate hikes there are going to be?
Yeah, I agree. That's exactly what I do think it does. And it actually has to do it slowly without rocking the boat. But I think that is correct. The economies are cooling down, some more than others. And she doesn't want to crash things. So the notion that we can have interest rates returning to what used to be normal now or anytime soon it can't happen. It's not going to be allowed to happen. But because of the valuation, I use the expression a slow grinding bear. I think that is the high probability. The possibility for a crash is much greater from bubble territory. But the broader market is not in bubble territory. It's just expensive. And it's had a very long-lasting bull, slightly kept alive on steroids of zero interest rates. However, from current levels, we don't want all world bond markets in negative income territory. That misprices lots of assets. And we haven't seen this before. I think if you've got to go back 500 years to get some sort of vague time when maybe the Roman Empire had negative interest rates for a bit. I mean, we haven't lived through this before, so there are no relevant modern precedents at all. But it's pretty unhealthy because so many other asset prices are calculated off government bonds. And when you're paid to borrow or fined for saving, that's not healthy. What normally happens in capitalism, you're paid to save your money and invest it and build up your plant and machinery and hire people and be entrepreneurial, which creates some growth. We haven't got that working in the West, well, anywhere in the world at the moment. We do still have entrepreneurial flair and great inventions, which is terrific. And the West, though, particularly America, has not lost its edge in inventing new products and industries. They may make the product in China later, but they invented in the West. And I see no reason for that to stop suddenly. In fact, trying to be bullish, I look forward in time to about 2020, when the demographics in the Western world, and particularly the US, become positive again. It's the generation called millennials. They get to be old enough to start wanting to get married, buy starter homes, make children, send their children to school and all of that. And it's a big generation. It's not as big in proportion as the baby boomers because the total population is bigger now, but it's big enough. And it will definitely drive a boom. And that boom will start to get some proper momentum from about 2020 onward. Unfortunately, we got to get from here to there. And it's in the next 18 months to 2 years when we got to correct the excesses of the slightly artificial bull market in the Western world completely, because most of the West has got similar demographics to the US. Certainly Britain's demographics are very similar to America. In Germany, which is the other strong market, they're worse, clearly worse demographics. When I look at all world markets in the West, the rest of the Western markets, including Great Britain, are cheaper, absolutely, in PE terms. They're less expensive than the US market. And that might give them a little bit of a cushion of they fall by less because they're cheaper to start with. As it happened in the British market, it was dominated by oil stocks and mining companies to a very large extent. And, of course, they've been clobbered already. And having had the fall, we probably got less downside risk than the US because we're falling from less of a height. I think that's the thing. But we're all correlated. Everyone in the West is going to move roughly in step with each other. And we're waiting for the Chinese correction to be complete. But once we can say China's now back low enough, it's got rid of its credit bubble, and it's sort of cheap. And by the way, the regime there has absolutely not lost control. China at the margin has been and will continue to be the largest buyer of most commodities. So all of those economies like Canada and Australia, whose economies rely on producing commodities, and the prices of those commodities will start to pick up the minute it's clear that the shakeout's over in China. And on my work, that low is likely to come earlier than the bear market low in the Western world. I've got it coming in later this year for the China low. And then our bear markets follow with the lows being next year. And so the top priority for the rest of this year, especially on the run-up to, in England, are we going to be in Europe or is Brexit going to happen? And in the case of America, running up to an election where, I mean, I don't know who can call the result on it, it's certainly not me, but it's a very unusual US election. And with looking like downside risks out there, it's about preserving value rather than taking silly risks.
So, Robin, given the fact that where we are now, you think this is a bear market rally, at some point will end, and then it'll be a slow grind to much lower levels into next year. Where would you be hiding out? You mentioned cash. I mean, you don't lose money with cash, and who knows, maybe we go to negative interest rates.
And also, as a parking place, your U.S. Treasury bonds, you know, but when one talks about the return of your money instead of the return on it, you're likely to get a return of your money in the U.S. Treasury market, basically. So high-quality government bonds are there, too.
What about gold?
My take on gold has always been that it's actually been in a secular uptrend all along. And within that secular uptrend, for 4 years, actually just over 4 years, it was having a cyclical correction, which is allowed to go up to 50% downside. As Ray Dalio points out, there has never been an asset class in which, if you're a genuine long-term holder, you won't at some point have to endure a 50% correction. Well, gold's done that. Of course, in other currencies than the US dollar, the low was in ages ago. It's quite clearly a roaring bull market in other currencies. And even in the US dollar, it's looking like just above 1,000 was the low, and it's looking good now. I don't think I can put my hand on my heart right now and say it's going straight up to 1,500 or something like that. It's actually overbought at the moment. But I don't think if it pulls back, it's going to go lower than about 1150, something like that. And at some point, I've got it going to new highs. Certainly, 1500 within the coming 12 months looks good. And eventually, it does look as though it's going to make a new all-time high. And you don't need to be a gold bug to do that. When I look at the stocks, lots and lots of high-quality gold mining companies, they're performing as though they're in a new bull market now. And when you look at some of the jumps, Barrick, you know, the company's being transformed. Peter Munk, who ran it when gold was in a bear market and therefore actually shorted the gold price, he's no longer there. And the new management is completely turning the company around and with a very great interest in shareholder benefits. Newmont Mining, the same sort of thing. And then Antofagasta, which has got some copper but also some gold. But these are all looking like good companies which are cheap and on a much better outlook for the future now. So certainly in my portfolio, I own an ETF on gold bullion. And I've even still got some silver, which has, again, had a long setback and is now coming to life again. But it's quite clear that the precious metals are not performing like commodities. They're performing like money. Most of the other commodities still look as though they're in a bear market, and the final lows do not yet look as though they're in place. What you've had is a massive short covering bear rally, and you're likely to go down and at least retest the low and make much more of a base pattern on their chart pattern. So let's say oil comes down, it's rallied from $26. It doesn't have to go to 20 or something lower, but it's very much likely to come down towards $26 and make a sort of sideways base pattern. After an 80% decline, you would expect a much more of a base than just this V-shaped bounce. That V-shape is the giveaway signal that it was just the bears closing. And, you know, I don't think we're anywhere near stability in the Middle East, nowhere near it. And depending on who you get for president, I mean, if it's Donald Trump, I think you're going to find American boots on the ground in different parts of the world. And that would affect the Middle East situation. But we're a way away from the stability that we would need for a true low in the oil price, I think, at the moment.
So given this, If you were to own any stocks, would you own anything like, let's say, high quality dividend paying, you know, the Coca-Colas, the Procter & Gambles, or would you simply avoid those at this point?
The magic words are needs rather than wants. Things that your life absolutely needs to go ahead will continue to do well. And actually, I would put Google on that list. For me, something like a Twitter or a Facebook is a want. But Google is a need. We simply don't function without a Google. So basically, it's the other things that you absolutely have to have for your life to function. Whether Coca-Cola is one of those anymore, I mean, I'm slightly worried that it's gone from being one of the great bedrock core holdings of portfolios. Now in this, everybody's got diabetes and we're hyper-tense about, you know, what goes into our body. It might almost become a pariah. I certainly don't think its prospects are what they once were. But core holdings that pay good dividends, and the dividend flow being much more important than what this year's earnings are going to be. Certainly any company that cuts its dividend, that's a straight sell, because that's effectively the management telling you, a shareholder, look, we think our outlook's rubbish, so we're not even going to pay you the dividend this year. Well, that means, you know, you don't need to own it. That's a very clear signal. But core holdings, you're going to eat, you're going to have water, you need electric lights, and you probably need Google for a modern 21st century lifestyle. There are things you have to have, and those will hold up and be core holdings. And the things that are just quite nice to have in a good year, well, they can go down and become cheaper before we need to buy them back again.
Well, listen, Robin, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
Well, we've got a website, www.globalinvestmentroadmap. And there's another website, which is the ecugroup.com, echocharlieuniversegroup.com. The two sites link together. I put a lot of stuff on the Global Investment Roadmap website, and a lot of my work is there.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Well, if you've been an investor in 2016, it looked pretty much like 2015. And that's until recently. We began the year with stocks falling, commodities falling. But since the early part of February, there's a new story in the market, and that has been the precipitous rise in commodities, most especially gold. Joining me on the program is my good friend Don Cox. And Don, I want to talk about your March newsletter that you did. And you had a chart of commodities. One was of gold, one was of copper, and the other was crude oil. Let's talk about the significance and what these charts are really telling us as investors.
Well, I think the fact that gold stocks are up 45% this year is just such an amazing thing, whereas the price of gold itself is only up 15.5%. So there's two parts of the story. One of them is that gold has been very strong, but the other is that the mining industry is getting its act together and will no longer be a profit destroyer in good times for gold. So those are two stories, one which is an industry is adapting to lower prices. And the fact that gold as a commodity has been the best performing one raises all sorts of questions. And I love reading the commentary in the various financial papers about this saying, how can this be? Because here we have negative interest rates in Europe because of inflation going to deflation. So why is gold up? And so they've been writing about this week after week. And finally, with the quarter coming to an end, they're going to have to be able to have to say, well, gee, it doesn't seem to be going away. Only yesterday, when Janet Yellen spoke to the New York Economics Club, gold, which had been fading, rallied very strongly on the suggestion that the Fed was not going to raise interest rates. And what Janet Yellen said was, well, we're going to have caution because the global economy is giving us concern. Well, the global economy is not an expression that you heard the Fed talk about much because they're concerned. concerned about the U.S. economy and U.S. unemployment. Those are the things that it's mandated. So I'm not being critical of the idea of the Fed thinking of its role as a preeminent international bank. But what it's telling people is that these people who have 1,000 economists backing them up and access also to secret information about what's going on out there, if they are this confused, then people might say, why should I be paying a near all-time high record PE for stocks if the people that have all this information are talking about the economy as if it's in dubious shape? And after all, this economic recovery has lasted for a while. So there's a long answer to your question, but gold, the fact that gold has done so well at a time when nothing else seems to have done particularly well, raises the question as to whether the fear factor is creeping in from the shadows, and we're not talking about the fear of Islamic terrorism.
Well, on this Friday, we've got oil prices still in the $30 range at a little over $38 a barrel. But the best thing you can say about oil, we're no longer back in the 20s. Joining me on the program is Kurt Wolf. And Kurt, gosh, that was perfect timing. The last time I had you on the program, it was at the bottom of the market. I think oil prices were in the 20s. Here we are now, about $10, $12 higher. So maybe this portends better days ahead for the energy patch.
I think you're right. We certainly feel better. I believe that we've seen the bottom. So the trend is now up, although, you know, we can always be surprised on that. And when oil was in the 20s, those were really bleak days for some of my companies. Of my 24 companies, about three companies probably wouldn't be in business for very long with oil in the 20s. And now that we're back to oil in the high 30s, near 40, these same companies can keep going for another year or so. And by then, we would hope that conditions will be stronger. So almost the difference between life and death in the 20s versus the high 30s for some companies. But for the industry as a whole, most of the companies are in a strong position, and it's just a matter of waiting it out. So we've been going down for about 18 months, and now we're in an uptrend that we hope will last at least that long.
Yeah, the reports I'm reading, Kurt, from the EIA, the IEA, basically feel that by the end of the year, the oil markets will begin to balance with demand growth. I think the IEA projects this year additional demand growth of about 1.2 million barrels a day. That's the one thing I think that was lost in the drop in oil prices, that, you know, lower oil prices, people consume more, and the population of the world is industrializing from countries like China and Asia, that we're consuming more oil despite the fact that we have electric cars today. So demand keeps growing, which is a good thing. However, I am a little bit concerned in terms of how high prices can go with all of that inventory floating around in storage.
That's great. I would add the demand side, some of the U.S. numbers. U.S. crude oil is going down about 8% a year now. It peaked last July. And U.S. gasoline demand is up about 5% a year. So those are two trends that are going in the right direction for improving prices. And on a worldwide basis, it's not quite that strong. But the EIA projection is that by the second half of next year, supply and demand will be back in balance again. We're going in the right direction. The worst is over. They're worried about how high price might go. And we're getting a little bit of that today from some interviews in the Middle East. And in another week or so, the countries will be meeting to talk about production caps. And we get the story right now, too, how the Deputy Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, a young fellow, wants to create a $2 trillion sovereign wealth fund, basically funded by Aramco stock after an initial public offering. And so the Middle Eastern people are talking about low prices, like $50 a barrel or something like that. That's good posturing for the meeting next week, and it's not a bad message for the Saudi people if you want them to diversify in the long run, because as soon as prices get stronger again, there won't be that much pressure to diversify. So there's talk today about a lower price than what we think we'll actually see.
You know what's interesting, Kurt, is you'll probably remember the gentleman's name. I can't think of it offhand. He used to head up EOG. He retired. He's come back out of retirement. He's raising money, sort of like a hedge fund, to buy oil properties as he sees it as a great opportunity. And it reminds me, Kurt, of what hedge funds did in 2009 and 2010 at the bottom of the real estate market. You had hedge funds raising money going into places like Vegas and buying large swaths of land and development and homes. And they did quite well, given the subsequent recovery in housing. So Papa apparently thinks we're heading close to a bottom as well.
He's a smart guy. He really called the peak in natural gas and shifted the EOG to oil shale. He's a real leader on oil shale, and EOG has been a comparatively much better performer as a result. So he's been retired now for a year or so, and he is in the money management business or money raising business. He's affiliated with Goldman Sachs, and he's making a bet that given enough time here that obviously we're going to see supply and demand come into balance. And you know, initially, Papa was pretty conservative about his projection for how much oil production we'd have in the U.S., and we actually exceeded that, but now we're going down from that peak. I hear secondhand. I haven't heard it from him directly, but I think he's talking about much higher production numbers for the U.S. in the 2020s, which certainly, you know, it all depends on price.
You know, it's interesting because you and I have seen these downturns in the oil industry over the last two or three decades.
Are you that old, Jim?
Well, I have gray hair. But, you know, we all know that I was thinking of 1998 when we got the price of oil down to 10 and a couple of years later as $35 a barrel.
Yeah. In 86, we went down to 10 as well.
Yeah. But the one thing about the oil industry, if you take a look at over the last, what, 2 years, almost 300,000 jobs have been lost in the industry. You can't pick up the journal on a monthly basis and read about, you know, either BP or Shell or somebody that's been basically laying off their employees. And then there was a story in the journal last week talking about how all the majors, with the exception of maybe Chevron, have failed to replace a good majority of their reserves. So you and I know that when you downsize, like the energy industry has done in the last 2 years, you don't flip a switch and start up again because there's nobody at a major oil company or even a mid-tiered company that's going to start ramping up, hiring people unless they know and can feel confident that the price of oil is going to be at a higher level or at least remain there.
Obviously, that makes common sense. That's certainly the way it would work. So $40 didn't make any difference here that we can see. And the companies definitely talk about they'd like to have some confidence that the higher price was here to stay. In the end, it's a forecast anyway, but I think what it really means on a practical basis, it's got to be here for a while before we really get a response.
And Kurt, given the fact that many of these companies are not replacing the reserves, I think Exxon only replaced about 75% of their reserves. That tells me if the oil price stabilizes, maybe in the $40 to $50 range, and cash flow begins to increase, that some of these companies would then, and also with an increase in their stock price, would use that opportunity to buy somebody else to replace those reserves, just like, for example, Shell did.
They're always looking to make advantageous transactions. At Exxon's meeting in New York a week or two ago, Rex Tillerson was saying that they're actually finding it more attractive to buy assets than companies. Companies that are really cheap anyway are those that have a lot of debt. And I think Exxon is concerned that, well, if they buy the company, they're going to have to repay all that debt too. So in the end, it's not quite as cheap as they might like. They feel they might be able to buy properties even cheaper than companies. But certainly the logic of what you say makes sense.
We've heard about a lot of companies that have filed for bankruptcy. I don't care if you're looking at J.P. Morgan or Wells Fargo. They've all increased their loan loss reserves for loans to the energy sector. You know, banks aren't in the business of producing oil or managing oil companies. So doesn't this create an opportunity also for the oil companies? For example, if I'm Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan, I have to take over a company due to bankruptcy on our loans. Well, you know, the bank's not going to want to sit there with oil properties. They're going to want to unload them.
Yeah, there's a pretty active market. That's always a good opportunity. I think what's the difference from many years ago is, you know, with interest rates low and money actually pretty readily available, it's kind of surprising that some companies have been able to have equity offerings and they've been oversubscribed, that maybe there's also an attractive opportunity for you and me. We don't have to go into a private equity fund or go into a hedge fund. We can buy some of these companies that are selling at very, very low stock prices. They don't look too good financially, and historically I wouldn't have touched them, but in a market where, you know, that's more readily available and manageable, we can get some of those gains ourselves. So actually I'm constructive on a company like Whiting or California Resources, and essentially I've already lost all my money in them, and there's not much further to go. But if they do hold on, maybe you'll get several times your money on the way back up. So there may be opportunities for us to invest in stocks as well as for private equity companies to buy properties cheap and for major oil companies to buy properties cheap.
Now, you use something when you use your evaluation of oil companies. It's called the McDepp ratio, where you kind of look at future cash flows, discount them back. I know because you're using lower oil prices. What do those McDepp ratios look like today?
We're kind of up in the air in many respects. Now, some of these McDepp ratios or some of these present value numbers, I've taken down quite a bit for the companies that are under the most financial stress because, you know, you don't know if they're going to be around to realize the higher prices or they're not making any money right now. But the McDepp ratios, you know, to take prices, they're low, definitely low. And some of them are really low. The global integrated stock, four of them, are McDepp ratio 0.75. That's below buy point. The lowest ones are in my small cap income payers. They're around only about a half. So from a half to 0.75 pretty well covers a lot of the companies. And so if you can buy a stock at a McDepp ratio of a half, you'll get an unlevered appreciation potential, theoretically, of 100%. And of course, if they have any debt, the increase in the stock would be more than that. The values are good. They're basically contingent upon prices being higher and not staying at the $38 a barrel. Well, at $38 a barrel, you can probably justify the current stock prices. And if we think that the oil price is going to be higher than $38 a barrel, all the current stock prices have the chance to appreciate from here.
Kurt, you and I have talked about this in the past. We've seen a lot of companies have had to cut their dividends. Where do you feel, in terms of the sector, where dividends are the safest? I imagine you're going to tell me it's the large cap oil stocks.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you in a slightly different way, too. Size is probably one of the very reassuring factors for the debt raters. And integration is a pretty big factor as well. The integrated companies have a built-in hedge with the refining business and a production business, so they're not under as much financial stress as the producers are. So all of the big producers that I have, the independent producers, well, not all of them, but quite a few have cut their dividends, led by, say, ConocoPhillips. Now, if ConocoPhillips were still an integrated company, they probably wouldn't have cut the dividend, but I'm not saying that they should still be an integrated company, though. I think they're doing a better job as two independent companies, refining, marketing, and exploration production. It's just that if you can't overpromise on a stable dividend if you're concentrated entirely in the producing end of the business. And for us, owning a diversified portfolio, we're not concerned about that volatility, but companies like ConocoPhillips and Marathon and Devon have had to back off on their dividend commitments. Even Devon and Marathon actually had too much debt, and they've actually sold stock at a much lower price today than what they might have gotten several years ago. But those stock offerings were oversubscribed. They also tended to signal the bottom in the market. And overall, it wasn't that much dilution. So it's probably a trade-off worth making given the circumstances. But constant dividends are not a good thing to promise for exploration production companies. Now, of course, in the Royalty Trust Group, we've been living with that all our life, that, you know, Royalty Trust dividends depend on the price of oil and price of gas. They go up and down. And investors with a longer-term approach realize they go up and down. But still, I would say that for the most part, investors in the stock market like to see steady dividends. And if the dividend is reduced or lowered for one reason or another, it tends to have an exaggerated impact on the stock price. ConocoPhillips is a stock that suffered that exaggerated impact. You know, it is a mistake by the management if you look in hindsight, but, you know, who does know? Who of us has perfect foresight? So that's a mistake that they put the dividend that high in the first place, but who knows? Anyway, ConocoPhillips is a very solid company. Its McDepp ratio is 0.66. It's among my lowest. It's the lowest in the large independent group. They're also more diversified, not only production in shale oil and shale gas, but in Alaska, and they've got an LNG project coming on in Australia, and they're still in the North Sea, although they may be scaling back on some of that. But they are a worldwide oil and gas producer. They're a good-sized company. But they did have to cut the dividend, and that makes them a cheaper stock than Exxon or Chevron, for example. But Exxon and Chevron are safer stocks. By the way, Exxon has gone through a golden cross where the 60-day average has gone above the 200-day average, if you like to watch those things. We hope that's a good sign of a new trend that could last for a while. And Chevron just made its golden cross. The independent producers are probably a month or two away from giving that sign of more assurance that a trend has turned.
So, Kurt, as you look across the spectrum of stocks that you cover large cap stocks, the mid-tier, and then, of course, a lot of the royalty trusts and even some of the smaller ones. Obviously, as you talked about Whiting and some of the smaller stocks, which are much, much riskier, but the rewards are much greater. If you had to put money to work today, where would you put it?
Well, I would put most of it or half of it maybe in the large integrated companies. Well, it depends really on what your rest of your portfolio looks like. But a diversified portfolio would have a solid position in the integrated companies and then spread the money around the other groups, the ConocoPhillips or Marathon and a large independents, as I call them, the pure producers, a Whiting or Continental Resources. Continental really is a much better company than Whiting, and it's equally attractive, Continental Resources and Whiting. In the small independent group, among income stocks, I like Dorchester Minerals, paying about 8%, McDepp ratio around a half. And in Canada, I like a small company called Birchcliff, which has a McDepp ratio around a half. It's a pure natural gas company. We didn't talk about natural gas, but natural gas has been quite depressed as well, and we're looking for that to do better over time. No, actually, we don't have as much invested in natural gas now as we did years ago. Most of the natural gas companies have become oil companies.
Yeah, it's amazing to see as so many of those companies started out with shale gas. And as you mentioned, like EOG, they made the shift over to oil in a very timely fashion.
EOG was timely. Some of the others weren't as timely. And that's why the Marathon and Devon had to raise some more stock. But they have good properties.
Well, they have good properties, and I suspect that with, you know, offshore drilling being very expensive and other regions of the world being politically unsafe, that a lot of the big guys have to be looking domestically here at shale plays. Kurt, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you do, how could they do so, please?
It's available on my website, mcdepp.com, McDepp spelled M-C-D-E-P, like David Edward Peter. And you can see the work I've done back to about 2002.
Now, I promise you, you're not going to want to go away. Coming up in the next part of the program, in the big picture, Jim Poplava has as his guest, Jim Rickards. It's a special big picture. Jim Rickards' new book, A New Case for Gold. And the information you're going to find in here is absolutely fascinating because it can be related directly to the welfare of central banks around the world as well. All of that coming up next as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.